Hello, this is Bob Dobbs again, and it's February 21st, 2014, and we're doing part three in our conversation with Dennis Young. Dennis Young is the Professor Emeritus of Art History at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Now, continuing our review of an article titled Painting and Its Paradigms, written by Dennis Young 12 years ago, we, at the end of part two, ended with the takeover of the salon in 1863 by the Skechers versus the Finishers. Now, this was radical. As I said at the time, it was like the SDS students taking over Columbia University in 1968 and winning and then changing the program and the rules. And this really affected Napoleon III, the emperor at that point in France. You can go to this article at www.dennis-young.ca. That's not underscore, that's dennis-young.ca. And scroll down a bit and you'll see Painting as Paradigms. That's what we're discussing. We're about two-thirds down the side of it. Okay, Dennis, welcome back for part three. You ready to go?
Yes, nice to be here. See what we can do.
All right, so we did end. Something came up at the end where you didn't think enough was said about the Quattrocento, that period after the Renaissance where there was a revival or an upsurge of interest in Neoplatonism, which was a recovery of the noumenal, the vitality of being behind the surface. Could you go into a bit about that phase that you wanted to put in our record?
I think because we really want to get to the symbolists, and we've got a long way to go to discuss the pre-symbolist scenarios. I think the best thing for me to do to keep it short is to read from the original text just a little bit.
And what is this text? Your text. Okay.
My text, yes.
And what section is that in? What's it under the title?
It'll be about my page four, so it's fairly early.
Okay, right, got it.
So, after I discuss perspective drawing.
All right, got you.
This is how it goes on then. However, the Renaissance conquest of the phenomenal world did not immediately eclipse the medieval concept of things not seen, hiding themselves under the shadow of natural objects. That was a quote, of course, from the handwritten book by Cennino Cennini in the year 1400, the beginning of the Quattrocento. Because that statement or that attitude towards art had been eclipsed by perspective. To read it, just rerun that. However, the Renaissance conquest of the phenomenal world by perspective, the perspective given by the single eye.
All right, so we're looking at the section, just scroll down a bit, under the word correspondences in quotes, and it begins, however, the Renaissance conquest. So take it away, Dennis.
However, I say in the lecture, the Renaissance concept of the phenomenal world did not immediately eclipse the medieval concept of, quote, things not seen, hiding themselves under the shadow of natural objects. This is a quote from Cennino Cennini's book of 1400, which indeed was eclipsed 30 years later by Alberti's writing, The Treatise on Perspective. This business of the shadow of natural objects, which we refer to these days as the noumenal, ever since Immanuel Kant invented the term.
Right.
So the noumenal comes back again on the formation in Florence in 1457, of an academy for the study of manuscripts arriving there after the fall of Constantinople. This academy expanded a notion from Plato, dear to various medieval philosophers, that the final aim of human existence was a vision of beauty and light, a notion that evolved into a species of sun worship that even seems to have been behind the theory of the heliocentric universe proposed by Copernicus, one of the great paradigm shifts of all time.
You're saying that making the sun the center of the universe or our solar system is actually part of this mystical idea a vision of beauty and light?
What you have to bear in mind is that as well endowed as Copernicus was with intelligence and the ability to work this matter out, it doesn't mean to say that lots of other stuff is going through his head. I think in one of the last two broadcasts, we actually said that Newton believed in witches.
Right, right.
And though he had invented the calculus and shown us a sort of picture of the universe that's still valid, or
right.
pretty valid. And then I went on to say that Michelangelo attended this Neoplatonic academy from the age of 15, and like Botticelli, derived from it the inspiration for some of his more bizarre imagery, as in the tomb of Giuliano de' Medici. Now, it's a great pity we can't show all this stuff to the listeners, but I'm afraid they'll just have to accept the fact that he was not at all friendly with Giuliano de' Medici, and when he did his tomb, he turned the heads of people away from where they should have been looking at the Pope, and so on, and he seemed to get away with it.
Mm.
Leonardo, in contrast, defied the trend, that is, defied this new idea.
The Neoplatonist retrieval. Leonardo's not working with that.
Yes, he defied the trend and effectively backed Alberti and his system, insisting that truths must be tested by the senses.
Which, 300 years later, would be positivism, right?
Yes, of course, yes. Yeah. That's
or
right.
Empirical science.
Empiricism, if you like,
yeah.
isn't it? In a more precise...
This is the beginning of it. This is the beginning of that notion that many people object to today. They object to positivism.
And this objection to positivism, as we shall hopefully see, actually comes towards the end of the 19th century. Maybe we could say it begins a bit earlier, but we're going into that a bit later.
Okay.
And I went on to say at that time then, as the Catholic Church's Counter-Reformation began, however, Neoplatonism waned for several centuries until the symbolists resurrected it. For instance, Gauguin's adoption of symbolism was coincident with his encountering a circle of younger artists, we'll go into that, who claimed to be reading Plotinus and the Kabbalah and adopting the cult of Mithras. You see, it wasn't just one simple thing, Neoplatonism.
Right.
It was a whole, what should we call it, carpet bag of different philosophies that were mystical and beyond the senses, which was the big thing.
Right, and you're into the middle class and the printing press, and all this knowledge is being retrieved, or new knowledge is being made, you know, 100 years before this. A lot of way more books for people to read in the 1850s than, you know, in 1550.
That's a very interesting point to make, surely.
You want to read a little more, or shall we go with...
Yes, I'm just saying this is a preparation for what we're going to go into later, but I might as well just read just a little more from the text, which says that Gauguin ran into a circle of younger artists who claimed to be reading Plotinus and the Kabbalah and adopting the cult of Mithras. Hence the appearance of dreamscapes and of the Tor cross in Gauguin's paintings of that time. The circle, this circle of young men, also read fragments from the self-styled 18th century mystic Emanuel Swedenborg, or Swedenborg, who had borrowed from Plotinus a theory of quote-unquote correspondences, which held that all things in the phenomenal world have a corresponding echo in the spiritual world. This convenient discovery had been first mentioned by Baudelaire in an essay of 1855 and elaborated in a poem actually called Correspondences in 1857. Indeed, Baudelaire was so intrigued by the ideas of Swedenborg that the hero of his early novel, his only novel, in fact, and it was pretty brief, Le Fanfalo, which is about a young man who's a bit of a melancholic. The hero of his early novel, Le Fanfalo, was cast as actually keeping a copy of Swedenborg's writings by his bed. And Baudelaire's poem, whose Swedenborgian first line begins, Nature is a temple with living pillars. La nature est un temple avec de vivants piliers, he says in French. Thus became an anthem for the symbolist movement. In the same poem, Baudelaire also confirmed his interest in synesthesia, that colors could be heard and sounds could be seen as colors, and so on, something that Kandinsky was later to claim he actually experienced in real life. Hence Kandinsky's woodcuts called Klänge, which in German is sound. So the woodcuts were named by Kandinsky sound. I could go on like this, of course, reading the whole wretched text, but I think we've sort of broken some ground here for something to enlarge upon for the rest of this conversation.
Here's my question. You have Whistler and two other guys taking over, leading the coup on the Salon in 1863. How does Baudelaire react to that? How does the symbolist movement react to that fact? Are they part of that gang, or they're poets and they're not? Relate the symbolists to this new change in the Salon.
They formed a group. It wasn't a large group for a start, rather because they were confronting a group that called themselves the Decadents. And I want to go into that too, but I would like to go a bit into Swedenborg, okay. and also to Helena Blavatsky, who became very popular among artists, increasingly so towards the end of the century. For most of his life, Swedenborg was actually an assessor on the Board of Mines of Sweden. Mm-hmm. But he was also a kind of universal engineer. He was a mineralogist and so on, in much demand by Charles XII of Sweden. He also wrote a book on conjugal love, on concubinage. So he had some interesting ideas about that. And I think probably when he wrote that book, he was beginning to change from being a positivist and an engineer to becoming a believer in this reality beyond appearances. At age 56, he changed to a visionary and a mystic, in other words.
What year was that?
He was born in 1688.
Oh, okay.
So we're 56 years later. Right. You can work it out.
Right.
In short, in the early 1700s, in the 18th century.
So it's 100 years before these guys start reading him.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Who triggers the Swedenborg fad in France? Is there a particular thinker, writer, poet, painter who draws attention to it? Is it Baudelaire?
Well, Baudelaire certainly did, but I would assume that something of Swedenborg had been published, posthumously probably. In any case, I was going on to say that whatever the case in how Baudelaire came across him, and I wouldn't be surprised if Helena Blavatsky didn't know about Swedenborg very well. That's why I wanted to say something about her.
Right.
Maybe we would come to that. Some of the things that you find in his references to correspondences was that he actually refers to mankind after the fall. Before the fall, man had other modes of cognition, he claims. These modes of cognition put him in contact with non-sensory dimensions. They were connected to the radiations of the divine light. That's a Neoplatonist idea.
Yeah.
However, we could still glimpse the other dimensions because the physical world was simply a reification. I don't think reification was his word. It's a popular word these days.
Yes.
That is, it was a thingification, if you like, of the spiritual world on a plane perceivable to the senses. So he was making an effort to get a bit of divine light to all of us, even though we were born after the fall. Before the fall, all of this stuff could have been recognized without any help.
Right, and that's Swedenborg writing that, not Baudelaire.
Yeah. Yes. That's right, Swedenborg. Yes. Swedenborg's talent, you might say, was to have summed up and popularized all previous Hermetic cults, just as Blavatsky was to do again later. He wrote a book It was called Heaven and Hell. He says, all things which exist in nature, from the least to the greatest, are correspondences subsisting from the spiritual world. Thus, when we name a thing by inventing a word, the word becomes a sign mediating two realities. It has a literal sense and a spiritual sense. And on he went like that. You find that Blake knew about him, refers to him, I think, in his short essay called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which one might regard as an attempt to take Swedenborg's book and reconcile the duality of spiritual and material that it identified.
Swedenborg, where is he getting this from? Is he coming out of the Freemasons or the Rosicrucians? Does anybody know where he got this tradition, or it was not a tradition, he made it up? You know, what? Why is he singled out as a...
I would assume, and of course, as I've tried to say before, this is not really my area, so I'm not too sure of how to answer some of your questions.
Right.
But we can only assume that since the Neoplatonist Academy of the Quattrocento, there's no reason to believe that people didn't go on writing it, even though they might have been persecuted, nor that the books that appeared after that weren't available to people who really were interested in the ideas that they contained. I don't find it mysterious, but I can't give you the exact date and time and place and books that he read. What we do know is that, for instance, Balzac, the great French novelist of the 19th century, had read Swedenborg. And in his early works, there was a trilogy called the Recherche de l'Absolu, the Search for the Absolute. He devoted a number of characters in that book who try to contact Swedenborg's spirit. The principal character in the book is a unisex, androgynous being of 17 called Seraphita, or Seraphitus, who is Swedenborg's cousin and has psychic powers. I should say that that is Balzac, not Swedenborg speaking.
Right.
Synesthesia is explained by Seraphita, or Seraphita, as part of the unity of things in the hereafter, not a unity in this world, as was the symbolist's position.
Does Swedenborg discuss synesthesia, or is that a Balzac Baudelaire?
I don't know, but I rather doubt it. I haven't heard of synesthesia being called synesthesia. Some people may have discussed, they may have said to their friends or something, gee, whenever the monks go high on that note, all the place lights up with a green light, you know.
Right, right.
But I don't think it was written about or characterized very much, but it increasingly became characterized and written about in the 19th century, and especially by these people. Swedenborg is the earliest of them. The person who comes later is Helena Blavatsky.
Yes.
Because these Swedenborg and Blavatsky are of some importance to the symbolists, I thought it might be worthwhile saying something about her.
Yeah.
She was a Russian, and already in the 19th century in Russia, there was a feminist movement, and her mother was the leader of it, Helena Gann. Helena Blavatsky, because she married a guy called Blavatsky, I may say, Helena Blavatsky was herself the daughter of a princess. Although, if you say that, if you know Russia of that period, you know that the children of every minor aristocrat in the whole damn country were called princes. Mm. The country was full of princes, which is why, for instance, in some of the great novels, you find a prince this and prince that.
Right, and they're minor aristocrats.
Absolutely minor. But princes, of course, in the English system remain next to royalty. You can't be a prince and not be related to the actual monarch. We know that in 1877, she published a book called Isis Unveiled. And at that time, she'd been 20 years in the East, especially in Tibet. studying under someone who she called a master, Master Maria, or just M, she sometimes called him. She has an interesting history before she does that, but we won't go into that.
Well, let me just say this. She's born in 1831, and you're saying a book comes out in 77, so she's 46 years old. That she's means she went into the East in her 20s.
Very early on, she was committed to the Eastern religions and the Eastern notions of reality.
So this book is published in Paris or in London?
Isis Unveiled, it sounds like a London publication.
Right, right.
She was a great linguist, I may say. She was certainly in America a lot. Could have been American, because in fact she was taken up by a couple of wealthy individuals in the States who more or less supported her financially. I don't know enough about her life to know whether she inherited any money. But out East, she might have led a fairly deprived life. After all, the spiritual people in the East never appear overburdened with fat, do they? I mean, they're all skin and bone.
But the people in Paris, the scene makers in Paris, grabbed onto this book and started reading it.
There's no reason to suppose that her books weren't translated into French, because as her spiritualist views began to sweep America, they began to get translated, of course.
Right, right.
How many languages? But we can assume several languages.
So what artist in Paris is grabbing this? Balzac is one. Baudelaire's dead. Who is in the 1870s and 1880s, and what art movement are they going to create? Are the symbolists responding to Blavatsky?
Yes and no, because she gets certainly a lot more attention from artists just a bit after the symbolists begin to, well, change.
Yes.
The interesting thing is you have not only theosophy, but you have anthroposophy, and you have others joining in, which continue her notions, or many of them, right into the 20th century. For instance, in Russia, you get a fellow called Uspensky.
Yes.
Who wrote a book that became very famous, Tertium Organum. There had been two organums before he published his book. One, I think, was by Aristotle, and the other by the British scientist Francis Bacon.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a pretty pretentious book, right? Joining great names like that.
Right, and that book is inspired by Gurdjieff, who's coming out of Russia like Blavatsky.
The popularity of Blavatsky spread across Europe by 1900, and it affected all of the arts, particularly the visual arts, and in the end, it created abstract painting. It's generally assumed, or often assumed, that abstract painting followed Picasso and Cubism, but it did not. Picasso never made an abstract painting, and there's nothing in Cubism that really suggests that you should or could. What did suggest that you should or could was to make something the natural reality of which could not be seen at all. But this becomes extremely complicated to explain, because theosophy began to absorb synesthesia, as we've seen. Well, let us stay for a moment with synesthesia. I've got on my wall here two woodcuts by Kandinsky, and they're both what you would call non-figurative drawings or woodcuts. One of them has a suggestion of a little bit of reality, but the other one is absolutely without reality. They were published in 1910. And from about that time onwards, you can read a lot of famous names in European art who were the followers of either Blavatsky or Uspensky or one of their followers. Mondrian's abstract work comes from, let us say, theosophy. Let's use theosophy as an umbrella term for all
right.
of these things. So he is a theosophist. There's a famous Dutch theosophist of the period who he followed. Malevich was a theosophist. And, of course, he is the person who introduces non-figurative painting in Russia.
Right, right.
For the Russians, the Dutch, and there must be at least a couple of others who simply are not appearing on my landscape right now. But because you can say that everyone, right down to really painters of the second half of the 20th century, claimed some kind of belief in this spiritual world,
yeah,
and addressed their paintings to it. It's amazing, but they did. It's amazing to me, who I'm not a believer, I have to say.
You talked about this circle in the 1850s, that started reading Swedenborg. Who were some of the people in the circle? Is that circle led by Baudelaire, or are they just anonymous people, these young people?
What happens, and I would like to at some point go into a rather close look at Gauguin.
Yeah.
What happens is there was a school in Paris, a lycée, which means the last senior school that anyone attends. And these lycées in France, if you gained entrance to them, were very demanding. They accepted, of course, wealthy people, but on the whole, they preferred wealthy people who were also very intelligent. And they taught Latin and Greek. So one of the results was that their students were pretty fluent in Latin and Greek. Now, if you're fluent in Latin and Greek, a lot of the old literature of the Christian Church, for instance, is available to you. And in this school, which was called the Lycée Condorcet, after one of the French intellectuals of the earlier 19th century, Condorcet. Often they were named after people who lost their heads in the Revolution, by the way. At any rate, this lycée was special. Lycée Condorcet was special because it took day pupils only. And all the other lycées, in some way or other, had to have people who boarded in the schools or nearby the schools. For instance, Duchamp boarded in another place, not in the school, but he had to be a boarder and not live at home. So they formed very close friendships when they were out of the school. They had the whole of Paris with which to linger and speak and go to the cabarets and the coffee houses and so on. So that you had from the Lycée Condorcet a group of young people who got themselves interested in Blavatsky and the rest of them. They found themselves, the group that we're talking of anyway, found themselves in the art colleges of Paris, including a sort of private art school that you got into if you couldn't get into the École des Beaux-Arts. And I think some of them couldn't. At any rate, some of them got into this private academy, the Académie Julien. The Académie Julien was founded by this guy called Julien, of course, because the French had suddenly come to make it more difficult for foreigners to come to study in Paris. And they sort of reserved the École des Beaux-Arts for French students. A lot of visitors to Paris at this time, and you can read this in the biographies of a lot of painters, English painters and so on, studied at least for some time in the Académie Julien. And these people studied in the Académie Julien. So in doing so, they came across a lot of what was going on in the art world that was not fit for the academy, that was not taught for the academy as in the École des Beaux-Arts, where you had to go for the Rome Prize. In the École des Beaux-Arts, you had the opportunity to enter your work for the famous Rome Prize.
Right.
That became the source of the sketch in the sketch finish controversy, if you remember.
Yes.
We talk about it.
The sketchers become more accepted and more respected after 1863. That's how we start off this.
Yes, so absolutely, absolutely. So there's a lot of, liberty for students now. if they don't go to the École des Beaux-Arts, maybe even if they do go to the École des Beaux-Arts. But what I'm trying to say is, and I should get there without dithering any further, they hear about aestheticism. They hear about art pictura musica, and they take these very seriously, because the idea of an avant-garde is very strong now among the youth of Paris, among the youth in the arts especially. They're looking for the possibility of, so to speak, taking the lead in inventing a new method of painting or a new ideology of painting.
This is the beginning of the counterculture meme, right? This is where the counterculture, which was popularized in the 60s.
The counterculture sort of laps into that easily. It sort of waxes and wanes, doesn't it?
Yes.
I don't know where things are at now, but the counterculture has sort of died down a bit.
Well, what the straits, the culture, brings up a war or two to diminish the enthusiasm of the counterculture. So you have wars at the end of the 19th century, and the First World War, then the Second World War, and in between, there's this upsurge of interest in the counterculture.
Campus unrest, the fact that the American universities particularly accepted many more students, and it wasn't difficult to get into them. It's all very complicated, that.
What were the Jacobins before the French Revolution? Were they the beginning of a counterculture?
I wouldn't have said that. I mean, the counterculture is a coinage of the press after about 1968. It's a fairly trivial word, a good word perhaps, but I mean, I don't think it's very old.
No, you're right. Yeah, so I'm saying that a lot of what the counterculture does in the 60s and 70s are reading these occult books that were being started to be read in the 1850s and 60s and 70s in this Academy Julian environment.
Well, and before that, I mean, if we had more time, we would look at the whole 19th century and we would look at the Romantics. The Romantics, self-styled, of course, but the Romantics, in a way, had their counterculture. And in the classes around the famous painter David, Jean-Jacques David, he had a lot of students, of course. And there are some hilarious stories about the activities of this gang of students who called themselves the Barbus. They grew beards as a sort of warranty of their objection to the academy and everything else and so on.
You're talking about students around
the 1820-ish.
Oh, okay.
One of the things which we have to bear in mind about France is that after the revolution, there were great changes. Even though Napoleon staged a coup d'etat after the revolution, he accelerated the changes, not as today we find, for instance, Putin in Russia drawing back from them and creating something awful.
No, Napoleon's the guy who brings in industry, the Industrial
Revolution. Napoleon said, look, this is going to be a great country. I'm going to make it and really make it. I mean, the system of weights and measures, the months and so on, the year, and all kinds of things. But, of course, he overstepped the mark when he tried to conquer the whole of Europe. At any rate, the point was that they had seen liberty, equality, fraternity. There was always this rumble among intelligent youth, especially in wealthy, intelligent youth in Paris. And it all centered around the university, the quarter where Latin would be spoken. You could sort of speak in Latin because they were also well educated in Latin. It's known today as the Latin Quarter. It was known then from the mid-1700s as the Latin Quarter.
Now, what university is in the Latin Quarter?
The Sorbonne.
Sorbonne. Is that the only one?
Well, there's the Université de Paris, and nowadays it has lots of branches in the suburbs.
Right.
So I don't know how many branches there are of the Université of Paris. It's a place where, in the 20s and 30s, the French decided that if they were going to entertain foreigners at the university, then the countries that sent the foreigners would have to build dormitories for them. So there's a campus way out of Paris.
You mean in Nanterre?
No, it isn't at Nanterre. Nanterre is one of the places where the instruction takes place. And in fact, it was in Nanterre that the big rebellion began in 1968.
Yes, that's what I was thinking of. So you're
It's called the Cité Universitaire. It's a good long bus ride out of the center of Paris, where there was, I assume, a very large amount of space segregated and given to any country that would build dormitory, but they were always more than dormitories. They were often very elaborate places.
You call it gymnasium? Is that where they get the term gymnasium? You know,
it would be a gymnasium. That's from the old Greek, I think.
Oh, okay.
But it would be a place where the chances are you would not only live and sleep, but you would have the opportunity to eat as well. I stayed there a couple of times. Actually, in the last 15 years, I've known the director of the Canadian pavilion there, because Canada does have a pavilion there. I have to say that the directors of those pavilions live very well.
But why would you be there? What would you you do research there, or that's?
I went there for the summer to take summer courses at the Sorbonne.
But you were at the other place.
To improve French. Yes, well, the Sorbonne is only the old university center.
Right.
It's the same as the University of Paris, but no one who's been in the Sorbonne will just talk about the University of Paris. They'll talk about the Sorbonne because it's prestigious.
Right.
I mean, it's an old, original Gothic university, just like Oxford or Cambridge in England. I don't know when it was established, but I would assume it was established around the same time in the 11th century.
But you're saying that you stayed at the pavilion, the Canadian pavilion.
No, my friend invited me to dinner there when I was in Paris, doing some research at the Bibliothèque Nationale. But when I was a student, I went there in the summer and stayed at the... well, in fact, I stayed where you could... any of those places that had a spare place. So in one, I stayed at the Swedish pavilion, and in the other, I stayed in the Moroccan pavilion. I could easily get off track here telling you about that.
We're talking about what's leading into this pretty dynamic period. All these famous artists that the dealers make millions of dollars off now were this countercultural guys reading occult literature and not wanting to be in the mainstream salon. Duchamp is part of that world, right?
You can say that, yes. I mean, he was a bit younger than most of them, but you can say that. In any case, my point is, to go back to them, they were very aware of lots of things that were happening in the world. And one of the things that was happening in the world was the redefinition of the boundaries of countries after the breakup of the great Austrian-Hungarian Empire. It was the breakaway of Norway from Sweden. It was the sensibility that said there is still Celtic peoples alive today who were pushed to the edge of Europe by various invasions from the East and who still speak the strange language of the people in Cornwall in England, in Ireland, in Wales, in Scotland, and in Sweden. So you have a sort of fringe of Europe. Oh, and I should add, very importantly, in Brittany, in France. This is worth dwelling upon because it does have a point to the story. One could say a lot about blood and soil. You find the first ideas of this starting with the German art historian Winckelmann in about 1750. Winckelmann made a claim that he had spotted a way to tell Greek sculpture from Roman sculpture. He said it was to do with the noble simplicity and calm grandeur of the Greeks, which the Romans didn't have. And in doing this, he fired up a lot of people's imagination, who said to themselves, well, maybe we can carry this on and can judge people, whole peoples, and reorganize the borders of countries so that the language and the people come together. And this was really an idea of someone a bit younger than Winckelmann, but in the same century, whose name was Goethe. Goethe belonged to a group of younger Germans in Strasbourg, this little group, who are now very well known in 18th century German intellectuals, had absorbed the Enlightenment in France. They had come to the same conclusion. They called themselves the Sturm und Stress movement.
Is that the Sturm und Drang? Sturm und Drang?
Sturm und Drang, yes. They also coined the phrase blood and soil, which became very popular in Germany. Now, at that time, which was before Napoleon, Germany was 300 small principalities, each with their own sort of way of behaving, their own laws, their own coinage often. So it was clear that people who spoke the German language really should speak it within a unified Germany. And the same was true in Italy. So we have, in the late 19th century, we have the unifying of Germany under one border, which took place around 1870, and the same with Italy. It took place around the same time. All those different areas of Italy that we travel through now were once principalities or dukedoms or some damn thing. Mm. But now they aren't, and they haven't been since the 1870s, 1880s. A mention of this appears when I come to expressionism in this paper.
Yes, you have the race, milieu, and moment. We talked about that in the last recording.
That's right.
But you're saying this is a counter movement to the mysticism, the noumenal movement. Is something different?
I'm saying that these very bright people, like Goethe, who was a good friend of Beethoven, both of them were looked after by a prince or a duke or something like that in Vienna. But what I'm trying to say is that this awareness from the Enlightenment of the fact that people had been absorbed into the wrong cultures so that they really didn't speak or share the same blood or speak really the same integrated language. And that's certainly true of the Celts, of course, because we have a certain Celtic language in Brittany, which came, in fact, curiously enough, in the early part of, probably in the first millennium, indeed, came from this push from the Goths and Vandals and all the rest who came from the east and pushed the locals out, finally pushed them into the sea, and they headed for England, and then they got pushed out from England to the edge of England. So you have Cornwall, which is in the edge. You have the Welsh and the Scots that are on the edge, and they are all really Celts. The push was so hard on the people in Cornwall that they decided to move again, and when they moved again, they moved back to France, to Brittany. That's why it's called Brittany. What is interesting about that fact is that the Bretons have always said, we've got our own dictionary, we speak our own language, we want nothing to do with you French people, or at least we don't want anything to do with you French people who tell us what to do. So there have been riots and objections for well over a century in Paris, and I have a photograph that I took in one of my periods in Paris of on the walls of the Academy of Medicine in Paris, in huge letters, it says, Vive le Breton libre, long live free Brittany. What is so interesting in that regard is that in Canada we have the French, and they are not too happy to be told what to do by the English majority. And although they haven't separated, they have tried and failed. But during the centennial of the secession of Canada from Britain, with its own constitution, its own government, that was celebrated in 1967. And during the celebrations, they invited General de Gaulle, who was then President of France, to come and be welcomed here. Before he left, he gave an address to a huge crowd in Montreal from the balcony of some big hotel. And during that speech, he said, Vive la France, et vive le Québec libre. That so annoyed the English-speaking population of Canada.
That would be Lester B. Pearson. He'd be the prime minister at that point, Pearson.
He would have been then, and he told him to leave.
Yes, leave. I remember that.
He was persona non grata. But what Pearson didn't know, I think, was that at that very time, there were far more people in prison in France because of the disturbances they'd caused for a free Brittany, the Breton League.
Right.
And it's a pity he didn't say so. But nobody said so. Nobody appears to really have studied the situation of the Breton people. This little peninsula that sticks out into the Atlantic Ocean is a very interesting and curious place where I spent quite a lot of time. I spent a lot of time primarily tracing out the footsteps of Gauguin because there was there a small town called Pont-Aven, and Pont-Aven had been selected out by painters for quite a long time in the middle or earlier part of the 19th century as a good place to go and paint because it was pretty wild country and so on. So there grew up a few little hotels and so on that took care of painters who would go there. That was where you could go and live very cheaply because these were cheap hotels. So at a time when Gauguin fell out of pocket, he had been very wealthy, you know. He'd
yeah.
been in the stock exchange. But there'd been a crash, and he'd lost a huge amount of money. So he was no longer rich, although he still had rich friends and tried to, I guess, in some cases, exploit them. But when he finally decided to become a painter, he became an impressionist, and he didn't do too badly. In 1886, which is a marvelous year, everything happened in 1886. It was the last show of the impressionists. It was the first show of the post-impressionists. It was the year of the first publication of the journal Décadent, and it was the first year of the journal Le Symboliste. So you had lots of things going on. And it was in about that time that Gauguin found himself in Pont-Aven, mixing with these younger and better educated people, because his education had been very odd. He'd been born in Peru. He'd studied to be a naval person, a navigator of some kind. And it was only when his father died, well, his father died early, that's why he started this job. When his mother died, he was about 17, and he'd spent, several years. Maybe he was a little older, but he'd spent several years sailing, so he was pretty tough. He was provided with a guardian. He must have been under 21, obviously. He was provided with a guardian who was very wealthy. And so this guy got him into the stock exchange and so on. But his own education was very shaky. He hadn't been to these posh schools in France. He'd been really doing as best he could. It's worth saying, too, that just as Blavatsky's mother was the leader of the feminist movement in Russia, so his grandmother was the leader of the feminist movement in France.
Gauguin's grandmother.
Gauguin's grandmother,
right.
Yes.
So he's older than these young students, and the students are reading,
that's right.
And they're
he's
from the Latin 40. Quarter. They know a lot.
He's about 40, they're about 20. But he's determined to be a painter, and he gets talking with them, and they begin to tell him, look, to use the term we've been using, what about the reality behind appearances. I can't believe they actually said that. But they said things like that. And they introduced him to the Celtic revival in Brittany, the whole business of theosophy, and other theories of the occult.
Yeats is involved with that in Dublin.
That's true. And Yeats is often called the most important of the symbolist poets. He's often mentioned as the most important poet of the 20th century, in the English language anyway.
On page 3, the first page of Finnegan's Wake, James Joyce refers to Brittany and the Breton phenomenon. And he also, Wyndham Lewis went there as a, 20-year-old after he left Slade, I think it was. This was the place to go to the esoteric, the esoteric anthropologies. You'd go to Breton. You know,
yes.
That was the fad.
That's fascinating information. So it attracted people from all over the place.
Yeah.
It even attracted me.
And you were doing this in the 50s when you were a student or later?
No, later. While I was teaching, actually, here in Halifax, 1972-73.
Yeah, what's interesting is Finnegan's Wake is not only the history of the world or history of Ireland and all kinds of things. It's also the history of art from 1850 to 1940. So Joyce knows that it begins in Breton, in the Breton area, in the 1880s. That's part of his subplot history in Finnegan's Wake. And he'll refer to the artists of that era. They'll be embedded on each page and puns and that. He begins there with the famous Tristan and Isolde story, where Tristan and Isolde are coming back to Brittany. And then it becomes a pun on certain parts of the United States. It's not talked about, really, maybe in your course, is that this is where people, artists, would go for inspiration of non-visual, to use McLuhan's term, to get the acoustic societies, the tribal people, the Celts. This would be esoteric. This would be exotic.
Yes, but of course we shouldn't think that all the people who became symbolists, the later symbolists that I tried to say were the first people to make non-figurative art, they weren't like that.
We're talking about Kandinsky and the beginning of abstraction before Cubism. Why are you bringing in the Celtic thing? This is the blood and soil theme?
I thought today the main track we were going to follow was symbolism. And although these are late symbolists, taking up the theosophy and anthroposophy and so on that was around, and I may add, for some of them, the mathematics of the fourth dimension, in fact, the mathematics of n dimensions. One of the people who introduces Uspensky is a man called Claude Bragdon. And Claude Bragdon wrote books on the fourth dimension for amateurs. There was also a marvelous book called Flatland.
Yes.
At the time. Have you seen it?
Yes, I know that book. That's well known. That's famous. Yes.
Trying to say the same thing.
Well, what, Matt, is that coming out of Riemann or Poincaré? Who's doing the fourth dimensional math before Einstein? Where are these people getting this idea from? Do you know?
You can get it from almost every book on art that you can find. I don't know precisely the answer to that. But,
yeah, which mathematician? I mean, this is before Einstein. I mean, it becomes even more popular after Einstein, but you're talking about before Einstein, people are into the fourth dimension.
Oh, yes. There were prominent mathematicians in Russia and France, especially, who certainly everybody read in the 19th century.
Do you think they were reading, these mathematicians were reading theosophy and mathematizing the unseen?
No, I don't. They were mathematics, the mathematicians. And what they were doing was trying to asking, new questions that applied to mathematical problems, I think.
Okay, so I'm not sure, I'm not clear. You're saying some of the symbolists went to Brittany.
Gauguin did, anyway. And because I regard him as a sort of the most interesting of the symbolists, there were a lot of people who sort of climbed aboard as the years went on. Many of them were very boring. I mean, I've, for instance, this morning, just looking through my bookshelves for things, there was a book on mermaids, for God's sake. And there are lots of paintings of mermaids that come from that period. And I would expect, well, I'm sure, that a number of people who drew mermaids also call themselves symbolists. Or you might say decadents, because we haven't touched on the whole idea of the decadent.
Okay, let's do that now.
Well, the decadent idea, it comes from the Romantics, but it also comes from a sort of general notion of culture and the sense of cultures rising in a sort of circular way, rising, reaching their apogee, and then falling. The falling part is called decadent.
Mm.
Not so much to condemn it as just to describe it.
Is that the flight of Minerva's owl, which is, you know, supposedly a supernova of creativity as the culture declines? Is it that idea?
Yes, it's that idea.
Okay.
To go back to these schoolboys who knew their Latin, they also knew about the fall of the Roman Empire.
Which is a cliche for us, but it's a big deal to know about that 200 years ago, right? You have to read to find out that point, to be part of your mental imagery. You have to be able to read Latin.
Yes. I mean, it was easier to understand and find that your school would teach you about the decay of the Roman Empire, decline of the Roman Empire, whatever, or the decadence. Because, of course, the more you get to know of the Roman Empire, I mean, it's on our TV screens all the time these days, isn't it?
Right, but it's Fellini's Satyricon is the first presentation
right.
of that. Yeah.
Exactly. You can bet your life the Satyricon was being much read by a lot of people who joined this, to me, very strange group. Now, I have got the entire collection of the literature that comes from the group. The journal that they published in beginning in 86, called The Decadent.
Hmm.
I had thought I might perhaps read a little bit about how it begins.
Yeah, sure. I have a question. Is this the Flanners and Theophile Gautier in the 1830s? Are they coming out of that, or is this something later and different?
I think one tendency that we have in this conversation is the danger of using a term and then believing that, you know, it has edges to it. But really, it doesn't. You can say, okay, well, there were people who believed that France was in a point of decadence. Whether it really was or not, it's another matter. But they could believe France was. They could be critical of France. They could sort of, in a way, say, well, if you can't beat them, join them. And they could help the decadence on its way by turning to some of the things that had already appeared in the Romantic era, which were sort of forbidden sex, particularly forbidden sex, of course.
Yeah, Byron and incest.
That's Byron and incest. Yes, of course. And androgyny and homosexuality, et cetera, et cetera. So you begin to see books and poetry and paintings where these kinds of imagery are seen. There's a fellow called Felicien Rops, R-O-P-S. Rops was invited by Baudelaire to illustrate the rejects of the Fleur du Mal. The interesting thing was that he was taken to court, of course, for obscenity when he published the Fleur du Mal.
That's 1857, just to give it.
Yes, he published in 1857, so that would be 57, 58, that would be the period. He agreed in the end to remove, I don't know, let's say 20 poems from it. And these he sent to Belgium. Belgium was, in fact, a place that had been used by the French who had offended the authorities for centuries, actually. It's very strange.
I mean, it's like Amsterdam, where you can go and smoke marijuana and stuff like that back in the 60s, 70s,
yes, 80s. It's more liberal. A lot of people went there, including the famous philosopher Descartes, and died there. Anyway, they found a publisher there for these poems, which were called The Rejects. But if you look at the paintings of Rop. Well, if you look at the, there was one illustration by Rops, a frontispiece for the rejects of the Fleur de Mal.
You have a copy of the rejects?
No, I don't. I actually bought one, and I found it had got... you would only buy a copy of that from an art dealer, which claimed to have the Rops original etching in it. But when I examined it, I was convinced that it was a copy, and so I sent it back. So I don't have the rejects.
So that's before 1886, when this Decadence magazine, which I've never heard of, tell us a bit about this.
It's in newsprint, and it looks like a newspaper. It's a journal, though. Maybe it has 10 pages or something like that.
Is it big like Life magazine was? Big pages?
No, it's larger.
Larger than that? So it's like a newspaper, but it's a journal.
It's the same size.
Right, but it's a newspaper's art form. Or a journal, they're mixing their media. They've got the newspaper layout, but it's a journal.
Yes, that's right.
It's more stable. It's not daily.
It's very cheap. Even if you're fairly wealthy, you don't put more money into a journal of this kind than you need. So we're lucky to have replicas of them. This is a replica of the whole thing. Let me see if I can read and translate at the same time. This is the editor speaking. His name was Bajou. He edited the whole thing all the time. And this is called To the Readers. He says, L'homme moderne est blasé. The modern man is blunted. The refinement of appetite, of sensations, of taste, of luxury, of jouissance, which is, I suppose it's joyful living, but jouissance is also sexual. Nervousness, hysteria, hypnotism, morphinomania, charlatanism, a charlatanism scientifique, scientific charlatanism, Schopenhauerism, one of the main philosophers of the movement. Such are the prodromal matters of this situation. In short, he's saying, leading up to decadence, this was all this mix of problematic matters could be applied to the French intelligentsia.
The blunted intelligentsia.
To new needs correspond new ideas, subtle and nuanced to infinity. The decadence, the political decadence, leaves us frigid. We abstain from politics like a show's infected and abjectly unreliable. The art has no part. It is alone the place of the rally of opinions. It's art that we have to follow in its fluctuations and so on. So we are, in any ends, we are the stars of an ideal literature, the precursors of transformism.
Are there artists that are influenced by this? Like, why are you bringing this up? It's pretty interesting, pretty obscure.
Hundreds of artists. And the point is, once you get a journal and the publisher who says this kind of stuff, it's the rallying point.
Yeah.
So people say, my God, you can do paintings like that, like Rops, like women crucified or women on the site of Christ's crucifixion licking his legs or something. No, I mean, it was blasphemous in the extreme. They love to mix forbidden sex with religious sadism. I mean, this was part of the point.
Yeah.
They wouldn't give you Jesus speaking to the fishermen or something. They would give you Jesus on the cross with blood all over the place and some sex going on.
You have every issue of this journal?
Yes, the decadent, but it's not illustrated.
How many years did this go on, this journal?
For about 10 years, I think. Then it changed its name, and it kept the same editor.
Bajou. Yeah. How do you spell Bajou? I want to see if that's in the wiki.
B-A-J-U.
B-A-J-U. And is decadence D-E-C-A-N-D-E-N-S-E or just S?
E-E-N-L-E, decadent, E-N-T.
Yeah, Paul Verlaine, he's part of that scene. They don't seem to have it in Wikipedia, but they do have it in the Encyclopedia Britannica, which I have never looked at on the net. It says, decadent literary movement, 1885, The Corruption of Adore Flupet, by Gabriel Vicary and Henry Beauclair.
Yeah, I mean, the story of the corruption of someone is just what they loved.
It says, from 1886 to 1889, appeared a review. So that's 3 years, Le Decadent, founded by Anatole Bajou, with Verlaine among its contributors. The Decadents claimed Baudelaire as their inspiration and counted Arthur Rimbaud as part of their scene. Inspiration, Mallarmé, Corbier, and other significant figures was Huysmans. He was really a big deal, who developed interest in the esoteric, and Arthur Simon. So these are all the guys that I associate more with the symbolists. They're actually gathered around this magazine, The Decadent.
Yes, but it's so difficult to untangle the so-called decadence with the symbolists. This is why I sort of tried to stick with Gauguin. The thing about Gauguin is, once he gets in with these young men, they are all Catholic Christians. And although he's not much of a churchgoer, he joins in and accepts the liturgy and the sensitivity to the Christian message. So he is not a decadent, nor are they. And the thing is, if you go outside of this small group, really, unless you go into the 20th century and you discover, as I said, Mondrian and Milevich and company, but if you try to say, well, these are symbolists and they're connected with Gauguin, they generally are also connected in a sort of way with the decadent movement. Mm. It's all very difficult. I mean, you've only got to sort of take a bit of a chance, and you're decadent. One of the interesting things is, especially in some of the cheap pictorial journals of the time, there was one called the Butterplate, L'Assiette au Beurre, in the 80s and 90s. They did nothing but publish criticisms of the government in the most striking way. I have one of their issues, original issues, called Crimes and Punishments, Crimes et Châtiments. They show you all these awful punishments that go on for prisoners, you know, methods of execution and all. And that's not decadent. I mean, that's an attack on the law and the way it's delivered.
They're trying to work within the system. The decadents aren't trying to work within the system.
It's difficult to say. You can tell that Rops should be classed as a decadent. The cover of this exhibition catalog shows you a woman, a muscular woman, with a spear. And God help the man she's after, I suppose. You know that this appeals to a certain temperament, that this appeals to people whose names they'd rather not have published.
Right.
I mean, that's point.
What's interesting to me is that this is 1880s, 1886. You got W.T. Stead in England starting the Reader's Digest kind of thing for people to subscribe to around the world, and he brings in a lot of the Fabian reforms. You got the Fabians happening, and they're all influenced by Blavatsky, a lot of them. Blavatsky's in the middle of this.
Absolutely. And Annie Besant, who was Blavatsky's good friend,
yes,
was a leading socialist.
Would she be shocked at decadent, or would she have some of these people? Was Oscar Wilde her friend? Because Oscar Wilde was seen as one of the decadents.
I wouldn't classify him as a decadent. I would say that he was a dandy, and not necessarily decadent. He was very bright, very witty, and people were afraid of his wit, of course. He sometimes had two or three plays going on at the same time in the great theatres in London. I mean, he's a very successful, and as far as I understand it, a polite and generous man. He was married. He had two sons. And then he recognized that he was homosexual. And he pursued young men. It was just after laws had been passed against doing that.
Mm.
Because for the better part of the 19th century, there were no laws against homosexuality, in Britain anyway. Certainly the aristocrats got away with it all the time.
So he's not a decadent, really?
No, he is not. He's a great playwright and a fairly good poet. He won the prize in Oxford for his poetry.
So who's a decadent in Britain?
Well, Beardsley is, I think, it's fair to say. I mean, because his poetry is sort of based on the adoration of pain. For him, the great thing in life is to be flogged or whipped.
Aubrey Beardsley. Now, has Art Nouveau come out of him?
No, not at all. In a way, Art Nouveau comes out of the Celtic revival, for one thing, in Britain, certainly.
Okay.
But in France, it's rather different. It comes out of the opening of the access to Japan that took place in the middle of the 19th century for the first time for 200 years. In the things that people who then started trading with Japan, in the things that they came across and brought back to Europe, artists found something new. Just like 100 years before, when there was a fairly active trade with China, China had influenced the 18th century.
Yeah, that influences Wordsworth and those guys, the first generation of Romantic poets. So the second generation is influenced by Japan.
Yes, if you like. I didn't know that Wordsworth was influenced by China, though.
Yes.
I was really thinking of the interior of the furnishing of new houses and so on in the Chinese style.
I was just reading a little while ago that Wordsworth was interested in Chinese culture. I hadn't thought of that, knew about it either, but at least they were, he wasn't doing that up in the lakes when he's doing his lake poetry, but China, as you're saying, China influenced culture in Britain in the 1790s or 1810s, like Japan does, and by the 1860s.
Yes, that's right.
Then you get Blavatsky is India in the 1880s, or Tibetan. See, it's going deeper into Asia. You got China, then you have Japan, and then more esoteric is Tibetan Buddhism or India stuff, Hindu. That's Blavatsky. That's the three phases.
Yes, but I mean, Blavatsky is looking at the mystics of India.
Yes.
She isn't looking at the decoration.
Right, you're right there. That's right. But it's influenced the artists. This abstract, invisible world. Now, this is an interesting point. You got China and Japan. Visible cultural artifacts are influencing the aesthetics in Europe. But now you got the invisible influence in the artists. The retrieval of the numeral. That's basically what you've been talking about. You know, with Blavatsky.
Well, that follows Art Nouveau, doesn't it?
Okay. Art Nouveau is back. I'm thinking Art Nouveau is
1890. Art Nouveau is not affected by Blavatsky at all. There may be some people who use some of the style of Art Nouveau in making a painting, for instance, who make a painting which is decadent and claim it's a symbolist painting. You know,
right.
So it's as crazy as that. It really is.
But Art Nouveau is before Kandinsky. You know, it's before the influence of
Art Nouveau, you might say, was the 90s and the first years of the 20th century.
Then 1910 with Kandinsky is the beginning of Blavatsky's influence, Theosophy's influence, Anthroposophy's influence.
No, I think Blavatsky really does influence the symbolists.
Oh, okay.
And,
right.
You know, they were all tied up with anything mystical. But it's these abstract painters who sort of really put into practice this notion. You see, there are so many factors that count that it's very difficult for me to not sort of take 20 minutes off, think about it, and write down all 10 of them, you know.
Right, right.
They, all these things influence these guys because it's never just one thing. The fact that Blavatsky was so well known and that her way of thinking about the spiritual life or the notion of the spirit or the her attempt to persuade people that there was another dimension, a fourth dimension of the spirit that was actually at work in the world, that was something people lapped up. But it doesn't mean that you could really put it into a painting.
Right.
It just means that it was a fascinating stuff. I mean, I've got one of her original books here. It's called The Key to Theosophy. That's in gold, impressed in gold on the cover. Now, what else is on the cover? There's the letter T. Now, the letter T is, in Greek, it's Tau. And it's a cross, really.
Hmm.
And everybody knows it's a cross. It's not just the letter T. So it's called the Tau cross, or the T cross. But it's one of the crosses used by the Romans to crucify people.
Hmm.
Where do you find the Tau cross in the paintings of the period? You don't find it much, but you find it in Gauguin, and it appears in the most strange ways. And you find it in this group of young men who he knew, who most of them, in the end, called themselves the Nabi.
N-A-B-I-S, right?
N-A-B-I-S. N-A-B-I-S, yes.
Yeah.
They were a little group who were at the Lycée Condorcet, and although one or two of them knew people who went to, or one or two of them themselves, went to Pont-Aven, met Gauguin, and persuaded Gauguin to change his attitude. Let me say a little bit more about the cover of this book of Blavatsky's. There's the T, which is the Tau cross. And everybody knows that there are three kinds of crosses in the construction of the Christian church. There's a cross with the horizontal member in the middle of the vertical member. That's called the Greek cross. It's a central cross, and you can find it in rotunda churches and in the Renaissance. And it's the cross that everybody says, for reasons unknown, but Blavatsky would say, and so on, it's the cross that is the least spiritual. It's more earthly. And that's what you can make of it if you want. Then comes the cross that Jesus was crucified on, according to most of the pictures. That's more spiritual. But the Tau cross is the most spiritual. So that's why the T is on the front of the Blavatsky book. And wrapped around it is a serpent. Now, why is there a serpent? Because the serpent is an image of mystery, if you like. It's the Ouroboros.
Right.
The Ouroboros provides you with one of these strange geometric problems of how far can the snake go if it starts swallowing its tail, isn't it? The point being, in a way, that it signifies something mathematical.
Right.
As far as I know, I don't know whether she understood it mathematically, but there must be something that tells you something like the Möbius strip. Now, that's at the bottom of right of the cover. At the top right, there is an actual Ouroboros just beginning to eat itself.
Yeah. Right.
And there is a strange star, which is a six-pointed star, made of two triangles. And then there's a cross, which looks like a cross, but the top part is, in fact, a circle. And it's, I think, something from Egypt.
The Ankh, A-N-K-H, the Ankh. It's a cross with a circle above it. I'm pretty sure that's called the Ankh, A-N-K-H, from Egyptian.
Yes, it may well be.
Yeah.
But it's not to do with the Christian religion at all.
No.
It's a sign of a sandal that you find in Egyptian vaults and so on. Let me just go back to the Tau cross. This finds its way into works by the Nabi, particularly into the work of one of the best of them, Vuillard.
V-U-I-L-L-A-R-D.
That's right.
Yeah.
If you look through a book of reproductions of We Are, you can see, for instance, there's a doorpost and a lintel, and you know the way it's put into the picture, you know it's a tour cross, even though you can't see one bit of the lintel making the cross. And that occurs again and again in several of Gauguin's works of that period before he left for the South Seas, this was, of course, before he actually knew Van Gogh, although he was about to meet Van Gogh. But you see it there in a similar way, just hinted at, but you know what it is. So it's a sign that he belongs to the gang, that he knows something about them, that it's like a...
It's like a secret society.
It's like a secret society, that's right. It's a sign that I'm one of you, and so on.
Is the snake, is the rubberus on the Tau Cross, or the is it the serpent that's on the medical caduceus? What is the shape? One of the crosses, you said there's a serpent. Is it twined around, or is it the Ouroboros? I didn't get which.
No, so you may be right. It's not the Ouroboros. That's at the top. This is more like the
Caduceus. Yeah. But the serpent on the cross is wrapped around the vertical.
Yes, it's wrapped around the vertical, then up and behind the cross and over the T at the top.
It goes right above the cross. It goes right up the horizontal.
Let's put it this way. Its tail is behind the cross, and as it comes out from behind the cross, it comes across the front of the cross, and then it goes to the back of the T form, and then it comes back to the front again.
Is that the second cross or the third?
That's the first one.
Well, you said the first one was in Greek, which is like a plus sign, you know, equal.
It's the most spiritual of the crosses, the one with the cross at the top.
With the serpent?
Yes.
Right.
With the serpent, which I don't understand at all.
Well, that could be the Kundalini if it comes from the east. There's all kinds of traditional religious meaning out of it, mysticism or Asia around the serpent, and maybe even in the Garden of Eden, the more esoteric.
Yes, well, I bet there is. I mean, I don't know.
But it's also, this book cover is what they call syncretism. She's got images from different religions on there.
Syncretism.
Yeah, that's a collage of miscellaneous religious influences. It's eclecticism. Syncretism is eclecticism in religious. And you're saying she's got symbols that come from different cultures there on the book.
Well, I don't think she was particular in sticking to this Master M. She was a very self-reliant woman who was like the idol of millions. So, you know.
That's right. So we have here the Salon and the Skechers. And then you have this mystical influence of Theosophy, and you have the influence of the Breton, the anthropological part. All of this is anti-establishment, right? Efforts to get away from the way industrialism is taking society.
Yes, to get away from positivism. That was
right,
what they
right.
often
said. And because there's more and more middle classes, more and more their bright children are reading these books, there's just all these cults almost all over the place. Are the Nabi before the Fauvists?
Yes, they're before the Fauvists,
right.
Yes. They start around 1891, 92,
right.
And they last for about 7 or 8 years. And then they reveal the fact that they've all been in this secret club. and they go their separate ways.
And Gauguin is in the Polynesia by then.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. He goes twice, comes back, and then he goes again. They've had 2 farewell parties for him, dinners. And at both of them, Mallarmé gives the toast. It's an interesting fact. That,
right. So Mallarmé he's the eminent grise of this 90s scene, right?
Yes, he is, very much. And it's difficult in a way to know why, but the most astonishing thing about Mallarmé is that he has this little apartment somewhere in Paris, and he opens the door every Tuesday night to anyone who knows him, who would like to come and talk. And really, one of the greatest achievements you could have in Paris in this time was to get invited or taken by a friend who knew Mallarmé to one of his Tuesday evenings. And for the most part, as I understand it, it was to watch Mallarmé take a drag on a cigar and then hear him deliver a few smart remarks, then go silent again for 10 minutes, and then make another one. I mean, it wouldn't be difficult to do a little research and find a really big list of people. I'm pretty certain Yeats was there. Yeats actually was not only there, but you mentioned Alfred Jarry just now.
Yeah.
Who had nothing to do with any of this, by the way. He was just a real unbelievable, imaginative, wonderful jokester.
Right.
But when they put on Ubu Wa, does that ring a bell?
Yeah, yeah, King
Ubu. I think it was Bonnard who made the I've got all the music for that, the original music.
Of the King Shit, Ubu Wa?
For Ubu Wa, yes.
Wow.
There are 7 or 8 songs. They are the most ridiculous songs you ever heard. 3 of the covers are by Jarry himself, and 5 of the covers are by Bonnard, I think.
Isn't that an 1896 Ubu Wa?
Yes, about then, yes.
Because look at this. Here's what's interesting. I never had it confirmed by anybody else, but McLuhan said that Baudelaire had a salon. It was called Hebdomadal. That meant every 7 days, Hebdomadal, Hebdomadal. So
yes.
Baudelaire has a salon, you know, in the 1850s. It seems to be a tradition. It's like oral dialogue, anti-positive, anti-writing papers. You get together and listen to aphorisms or oracular conversation. That seems to be what's influencing symbolists, because you have Mallarmé continuing it.
Yes, but you have to realize that the salon was an old, old custom among the aristocrats.
Madame de Staël's salon was very influential in triggering the French Revolution. Have you ever heard of that? Madame de Staël.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Madame de Staël, yes.
Wasn't she the beginning of these salons, or it was...
No, not at all. I can't tell you when they began, but I would say they began most likely after the death of Louis XIV.
Right.
Because Louis XIV forced everyone more or less to live in Versailles, you know, and they all just, they were fed up to the teeth with living in Versailles. So when he died and the next king was too young to take the throne, they had the regency. Suddenly, you know, all the aristocrats said, gee, you know, we're free at last, free at last. And they built great houses on the South Bank in Paris, the boulevards. They were the first big townhouses built as townhouses, you know. Well, I suppose there were other cities where they occurred as well.
And this would be Voltaire's big period, 1750s to the Revolution, 17.
Yes, and, you know, you've got a whole change in the way decoration took place. That's when the chinoiserie came in, when the Chinese style.
Right.
The doors and the windows and the walls were decorated, and the picture frames and everything had these touches of the Chinese. They're not blatantly Chinese. But if your eye is good enough and you know about the history of the times, you can see it all around.
So this is the beginning of the cultural center of Paris, the city becoming a cultural center, not the court.
Absolutely. It must make a huge difference to lots of things, I would think.
Right.
I mean,
so the salon is one of the key new phenomena.
That's right. And some of these people will be holding a salon.
So you get Baudelaire does a salon, Mallarmé is part of the salon, and then Wyndham Lewis had one, James Joyce sort of, a bit more eccentric. But this is the tradition McLuhan carried on, and that's what I would go to 60s and 70s would be his Monday night seminar, or not a seminar, Monday night salon, where anybody was open, allowed to come in.
How interesting. I didn't know that existed. But
They're famous in the McLuhan biography. If you check out a book, this started. He always cared. He had the salon in St. Louis University in the 40s when he'd be showing ads. Now, he had studied the symbolists and Mallarmé and Baudelaire at Cambridge because I.A. Richards and those guys were influenced by T.S. Eliot and Joyce and those poets and Yeats who were fascinated by Mallarmé and the symbolists. That's what changed British poetry. Now, you have Gertrude Stein doing a salon in Paris. But this tradition McLuhan picked up on early because he was a great talker. When Gertrude Stein came to Cambridge in the 30s, when McLuhan was there, he heckled Gertrude Stein. He's just a student, you know. Yes, and he was following in the footsteps of Wyndham Lewis, who heckled Gertrude Stein. So McLuhan's a real Lewisite. So whenever he gets to a university, starts teaching in the late 30s, he has a salon gather around him because he can't stop talking.
Then in that case, he brings his salon with him wherever he goes.
Yes, because you witnessed one.
So I witnessed one.
Yeah, monologue salon. And you're saying everybody would be quiet when Mallarmé wasn't speaking. They wouldn't talk. They'd wait for him to say something else.
Well, that's what I don't know. I'm just kidding on that.
I know. McLuhan was a rude salon, a rude monologuist who would do it at wherever he got an opportunity.
One certainly has the impression that Mallarmé was not an extrovert.
He was more of a quietism.
I would think he was. I mean, yeah.
So here he is. Mallarmé is influencing people in the 70s, 80s, 90s. He's a major figure.
Okay. Now, let me just throw in one more spoonful of sugar. And that is that what with Japan and what with the folkloric painting, which did come to get a lot of regard because of this change of blood and soil stuff, you know.
Yes.
You had the acceptance of children's work, and you had the acceptance of untrained people's work, the folkloric work.
Right.
One of the things that you begin to see in Gauguin, for various reasons, Gauguin's people are not always very academic drawings of the female body, which is generally the subject of his South Sea paintings, isn't it? But the nabi are much more likely to come up with a sort of very regressive, childlike way of drawing. And I have an etching by Bonnard, which most people would say, well, if that's art, I don't want it. It really is like a child's drawing. And all you can say about it is, well, yeah, it's a child's drawing. But if you have patience and look at it, you can see that it's also an artist's hand in distributing the imagery and so on. But by God, the imagery, it is so childish. It could be a five-year-old.
On the surface, it looks childlike. But the unseen has a design, an intelligence behind it. Is that the metaphor there?
I think that's a very good point you make, yes. And also, I suppose you have this sense, too, that the child is less sophisticated and less corrupted by society. At least that would be Rousseau's attitude, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and mysticism goes that way, too.
I mean, Rousseau had a lot to say about children.
And Rudolf Steiner, the founder of Anthroposophy, starts the Walden Schools, and it's all about this sacred way of raising children. You know, and appreciating their divine innocence and all that. Let's end on this point. I'm wondering, where does Walter Pater, and the idea of aspiring to music, does that come into this this world you've been describing of the end of the 19th century, the musical, Pictura Musica? Is that going to come in?
You recall that there'd been talk about it from about 1750.
Yes.
That Delacroix had blatantly written in his journals that a picture has meaning even though you're too far away to read what's going on in it, because you see the color. And the color is like, that's the musical thing going.
Right, right.
That's followed up. And you still have it going, as I said earlier, with Kandinsky, who calls...
Crane.
But you see, it gets mixed up with synesthesia.
Right, so that's where synesthesia comes in, the mixing of the eye and the ear.
That's right.
That's an important point. So that brings us right back to the beginning. So thanks again, Dennis, and we'll meet again at some point and record part 4.
Okay, Bob, it's been a real pleasure.